Yes, sir.
Are you forging ahead, or can we ask off-the-subject questions?
Anything you like. No way does that imply I will be able to give you an answer.
Okay. The subject is charity, and I have thought that I understood that, well, basic charity, I think, is 10% of income, and I had thought that I understood at one point that that money needed to be given to organizations that are teaching Torah ideas. But then I wondered, well, what about someone who's just plain in need, you know, someone who needs money for food or clothing or shelter? Is that a different kind of thing if you give money to them, or is that charity also and goes toward fulfilling that obligation of 10%?
Yeah, the latter. That's my understanding. Anybody in need, okay, or so on, right?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, and second questions.
Yeah, the actual,
unrelated.
The just to clarify also, the Shulchan Aruch states that the 10 is the average, not the minimum. A person could satisfy his need for charity with a very small amount once a year, if he really just wants to have the bare minimum. 10% is like the average, and but it says a person's not allowed to give more than 20%, unless he's like, you know, extremely wealthy, like a, you know, a multimillionaire. Then he can give I think up to 50%, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm not even sure, maybe there's not even a limit there. But a person is not allowed to give more than 20, so he shouldn't impoverish himself. The average is 10, and the minimum could be like a small amount. Maybe some change once a year, just satisfying the need. See, that's the Shulchan Aruch formulation. Go ahead, you said you had another question?
Well, let me go back on that. So there's not a halakhic obligation of 10% then?
No, that's the minimum is less than that, far less than that.
Okay. And is that the same then as the tithe, or is the tithe a completely separate deal?
You mean from the produce?
Yeah.
I don't know.
And does that have any bearing on us today? I kind of had always assumed those were synonymous, but I'm not sure that's correct.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are synonymous because, again, if the point is that a person's not supposed to give more than 20% of their wealth, so it doesn't matter, you know, he has to take a full accounting of all of his wealth, wherever it's coming from. It could be from chattel, it could be from produce, it could be from rent income from buildings that he owns, and then he takes the entire sum and he's got a limit to give no more than 20. So it seems to me that it's all one thing. It's all one group. So if you give some of it to the Levites and to the priests, it would seem to unless those are separate gifts over and above. That's what you're asking. You're asking about the tithes that you give to the Levites and the priests. Is that part of the 10, right?
Right.
Yeah. That's a little bit. It's a good question.
Okay. Second question. So in the days of King David and around in there, there were prophets. But there was no internet and no instant communication. So how did people know kind of who the prophets were and who was an important guy and who wasn't? Because there were no pictures either. So we were last night walking through, you know, King David's departure when his son Absalom was chasing him, and people came out to greet him, and Cal raised the question, you know, how did people know who he was? And similarly, I guess, with Samuel was a prophet and, you know, gave information, but how did people know, well, this is the guy you go to? Was it just, do we know? Was it kind of word of mouth? They just got around?
It would be clear. It would be word of mouth, but for those at the distance, but when a person would be in the company whether it's a large crowd or a small crowd, everybody would see who is the one that's on the throne, who is the one that's being led by the chariots, and they'd see clearly who's getting the center of attention. So that would be a clear indication that that would not be a hoax.
Okay.
Right. Like similarly today. The person wants to know who the president is, and there's no newspapers, no communication. So let's see who's the one that's being escorted in the black limousine.
Yeah.
Or who's being surrounded by bodyguards. That would be the indication.
Okay.
May I add something?
Sure.
Well, you know, Israel's a much smaller place than, say, the United States. So it's not like somebody from Oregon trying to recognize somebody from Florida.
Right, but still at a certain point, distance, you know, you can't see past a few miles. So it's overkill, whether it's the United States or whether it's, you know, me in Israel. The question will still stand. If they had never had any visual, you know, validation of who that person is, so how would they know?
Well, there are going to be modes of dress and descriptions of people floating around, and these are things that aren't going to have traveled very far.
No, they had. I mean, they definitely had communications. They had people that, you know, the horse runners that they had had delivered messages in the times of, let's say, you know, Mordechai and Queen Esther and the story of Purim. So you see that the way that they delivered information was by horse, and they were able to, you know, go many, many distances, and it spread, albeit slower, but it did spread. All right.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so we're forging ahead now in Qoheleth. We're in chapter 6, and we're in verse, we've got up to 5. Okay, so let's take it further. And I just went on the line that the, let's see, somebody's having problem with audio online. Alright. So 6:5 we're up to. And we were talking before, where we left off a couple weeks ago, is that King Solomon was making a comparison, and he's saying that the stillborn would be better off than a person who toils and never gains any type of satisfaction. And what's the reason why? So he says in 5 that also the son he has not seen, referring to the stillborn, and he didn't know the tranquility this way or that way. Meaning there was no, according to the commentators, so it didn't have to go through all of the toil to end up with having the same exact end. So it ends up that the stillborn and the person who toils and has really nothing to show for it, so the stillborn got to the same place as the other individual, but lacking all the toil. Now, of course, the problem with that is that the stillborn, you can't say the whole concept of saying, well, it's better off. So what's wrong with that statement? When King Solomon says that in the end of 6:3, when he talks about the first person and 2, where he tried to acquire lots of possessions, and he did, but he never was satisfied with anything. He never satisfied his desires. God didn't allow him. But there he meant not God, but I mean the own workings of his own emotions. He wouldn't dig into his own possessions to consume it. It would bother him. So he never enjoyed what he amassed, all of his fortunes, and he never got to use it. And somebody else is going to consume it, some strange person he doesn't even know. So the first, King Solomon says this is a futility. There we said, what's a futility? Is that the person is making is concerned about something which is going to happen after he's dead. That somebody else is going to use up his wealth. But that is a foolish way to live, to be concerned about that which is not going to have any effect on you, because once you're dead, it won't have an effect. Correct? And then he says in 6:3, he says, if a person would have 100 children, and he lives many years, and the long years, and his soul does not get satisfied from any good, and he also has no burial, so I said, better than this person is the stillborn. So there, the idea we said is that the stillborn didn't have to go through all the toil to end up in the same place. Now, you keep in mind that, again, he says at the very beginning of this series of verses, I don't want to say the beginning of the chapter, because the chapters are not made by us. They were made by the Gentiles, for convenience of debating. But the beginning of this chapter happens to be a good spot, so it could be they chose it for that reason. But you see that he says that I see an evil under the sun. So under the sun means to say that if our assessment is limited to just looking at the phenomena on earth, so then we're going to come up with poor conclusions, because we're only looking at the human condition from birth until death. And if we look at it that way, so then yes, you'll come up with the conclusion that the stillborn is going to be better off than the guy who labors his whole life and then has nothing to show for it, because I'm not looking past that point. Right? That should be understood. We discussed that a few times. Okay. So what is this point now in 5? So Sforno says that the tranquility of the stillborn is better off because it didn't toil. And it didn't have to go through all the pain like this person who amassed all this wealth and didn't get to use it. So that's a statement that's made by, not King Solomon, he's echoing the opinions of foolish people. Then he goes on. Now we're going to go through and break some new ground now. And we actually discussed this, I think, months ago, but now we see the source right here in Koheles. And he says further, if a person would live 1,000 years, two times over, that means a person lived 2,000 years, and any good he did not experience, is it not to one place that everybody goes? So we'll have to ask why he's bringing this in now, and also just what is this idea? He goes on in 7, and he says, all the toil of man is for his mouth, and his soul is not full, but also his soul does not get satiated. In 8, what is there greater benefit to the wise man from the fool? What is there to the poor man that he knows to go in this life? That sounds harsh. He's saying, what benefit is it to the wise man? And the last verse we'll take today is going to be 9, which is, better is what one views with his eyes than what he does, how he occupies his soul. This too is a futility and a vexation of spirit. And I hope to show you that this is a series. There's a sequence going on in these verses. I say that to help, not to make it difficult, but saying that to help out as you approach it. Okay. Somebody had a question?
Just factual on verse 9. You had better is what he sees with his eyes than the second part you refer to as soul?
Yes. I'm saying that based on the commentators.
Okay, because Judaica Press has it, better is what he sees with his eyes than that which goes to sate his appetite. Is that a correct translation?
Not according to Sforno, at least. Sforno says that better is the attainment is reached with the senses from what he goes with his soul. What does it mean? He means what he attains with intelligence to reach any type of eternal existence. And this person is only striving to reach attainments that are sensual alone.
Okay.
Furthermore, you have another one that says, I think it's a Ben Ezra who says this. Well, that's a previous verse, okay. Yes, yeah, so that verse. Yeah, that's why it's so vital to have the commentators. You don't know where these are, these publications are getting their ideas from.
Yeah, that's the art scroll has on that verse. Better is what the eyes see than what is imagined. It's kind of a whole different idea there, too.
Yeah. That's really far-fetched. It doesn't say imagine. You have to... You go back to the real, you know, the commentators, the Rishonim. The Rishonim, that in English, that means the ones that came first, meaning the original commentators. They were closer to the truth. You think of like Maimonides and Rashi and Ibn Ezra and Sforno. I mean, these are, you can see from their writings how brilliant they were. So let's go to the first verse. So the verse is 6:6 is where we're on. So what does it mean if a person would live 1,000 years two times over? But any good, and according to Unculus, the Targum, I should say, he says, what is the good that he did not involve himself in? Torah, meaning that which gives him eternal existence. So if a person lives even 2,000 years but is not involved in anything that's going to help impact the eternity of a soul, is it not true that's the one place where all people go? So what is his main comment here?
Rabbi, it seems like there may be a continuation from the verses before that. Because right before that in Labyrinth 3 and continuing to 4, he's talking about the stillborn. Because it says, well, he comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and his darkness, his name is covered, and he doesn't see the sun, and so forth. And then it comes along and says, and if he lived 1,000 years twice and experienced no pleasure at all, do not all go to one place. So I'm wondering if he's making the same point as before with regard to the stillborn, except with somebody, okay, now in contrast to a stillborn, let's talk about somebody who lives 2,000 years.
Very good. Excellent. Right, meaning to say that now that he now made a statement in terms of the stillborn being better than the one who strives, so that might awaken a question in the reader. Well, yeah, fine, maybe a stillborn is better than that case, but maybe there's something better than the stillborn. Let's say the person didn't have this type of a comparison. Let's say the person just, he lived for thousands of years. You can tell me that's not better? Because that awakens a question. Because it's a very harsh statement to say that the one that was a stillborn didn't partake of life whatsoever. He's better off than one that had all this toil and misery. All right, so let's get rid of the misery from the equation. Now you can't tell me a stillborn is better, because the stillborn is only better than one because he's not going through, he's ending up in the same place, right? So the question that a person might have is that, well, that's only if you compare a stillborn to somebody who has a miserable existence. But let's say you remove misery from the equation. Now, perhaps, you can't tell me the stillborn is better anymore, right? Is that a good, does everybody agree with that step, the first step I'm taking?
So you're taking away the step of being stillborn.
No, the step of the misery, because he's trying to say in the previous verse that in 3, that the person who can have a long life, many kids, but if he doesn't enjoy anything, and everything is attained with pain, or if he's like a person in verse 2 where he didn't get a chance to enjoy anything because he was just worried about diminishing all the wealth he amassed. So better off than these two people is a stillborn, because the stillborn ends up going to the same place and but didn't have to go through all the toil. So a person might agree with that if you're comparing the stillborn to somebody who toiled his whole life. But let's say I remove all the toil. Are you going to tell me if stillborn is better than somebody who lived 2,000 years? That seems to be the question he's asking now. It's a natural response that a person might have. I just want to make sure you see the flow.
I don't see him taking away the toil.
Well, why is he asking about somebody who lives for 2,000 years now, right after he talked about a stillborn being better? My assumption is that there's a question. See, there's a lot that's going on here that's not written in the text. Meaning to say, why is he writing one verse after the next? There may be certain assumptions that he now knows he has to address. Once he made a statement that the stillborn is better than a person who has toil, so a person might say, a thought in their mind, well, yeah, stillborn is only better than a person who toiled because the person had all this toil and aggravation. But let's say the person didn't have the aggravation. Are you going to still tell me the stillborn is better? Do you see the flow?
No, because it seems to me that the contrast is actually the length of the life, not that somebody is contrasting the toil, but he's saying what somebody might say, well, at least this, if you're not stillborn, at least you get a chance to live. And what it, you know, and he's saying, well, even if you live 2,000 years, but no good came of it, we all go to the same place, or at least if that's the attitude of those under the sun.
But why is he saying that verse right after the verse about the stillborn?
Because somebody's going to object to the stillborn and say, yeah, but stillborn has no chance at life, at least if somebody has lived. I mean, they at least live.
Okay, so he's just taking that. He's just taking it to the logical. He's taking it to the logical conclusion. If you're going to tell me that, at least if somebody lived, it's better than a stillborn. So King Solomon's going to the extreme. He says, I'll give you that, and I'll raise you one. Not only is that not true, but even a person that's 2,000 years. He's taking that argument that you just gave to his logical conclusion. He's saying, you want to take that case? He says, I'll give you even more. I'll go with you on your question, and I'll even strengthen your question, is what he's doing. You want to say that somebody who at least lived is better than the stillborn? He says, I'll tell you, somebody who lived 2,000 years is not going to be better than the stillborn. But I'm just showing you how this verse follows from the statement of the stillborn. I'm just trying to show you that there's a sequence going on here. It's not just haphazard verses. Because once he makes a statement that the stillborn is better, so people are going to think, yeah, in one case it's better. But not if a guy has no toil. If a guy has no toil, so then living is better than being a stillborn. See, he says, you think that's true? How about a person who lives 2,000 years? Do you think, according to you, it must be even better than a person who lives 80 years, right? That's what you're saying, Jim, right?
Well, except the toil. I don't see that the toil is a necessary portion of this, but yet.
Okay, well, let's go with it that he is, because why else would it be that he's now responding and saying a very long life is still going to be worse? It must be because there's an unstated question over here that he's trying to address. Because he knows that once he says a stillborn is better, people will object and say, yeah, that's only better if you had a terrible life. So it's better off that you never were born if you had a terrible life. That I agree. But let's say you didn't have a terrible life. Then you can't tell me a stillborn is better. Then having lived is better. So King Solomon would say to that unspoken question, he says, if you want to take that angle, let's strengthen your question. You want to tell me that life is better than a stillborn? I'll show you how the life that is twice as long of anybody who ever lived is not better than the stillborn. Because the longest lives recorded in the Torah are about 1,000 years. Go ahead.
Maybe my confusion is with my translation, because I believe your translation was different. So the reason I'm confused is because mine says, even if he should live 1,000 years twice over, but find no contentment. But yours says something else, right? I mean, you're translating it as, but has no good. Is that correct?
No, because even if he lives 1,000 years and he has no good, even without the toil, meaning all he's saying about this person is he doesn't get involved in the good, but there's no aggravation here. Here it doesn't say that he's toiled and that his wealth is going to somebody else, or that he doesn't talk about that he's not satisfied. Satisfaction is a physical thing. So here he's not lacking any of those things he said earlier, if you look carefully. It says in 3 that his soul is not sated.
Well, but like I said, mine says, but find no contentment, which is about the same thing as satisfaction.
Right. I think it's different. It's telling you that the people will think that the stillborn is only going to be better off in one comparison. But you can't tell me a stillborn is better than a person who lives a good life without the toil. If it is going to be the same, if you can tell me that this verse is talking about the guy's aggravation, so what's the new point? This has to be a new point here. But look what he says, his response why it's no good is, is it not true that to one place everybody goes? What's his point now? He's now trying to answer the people that think that a long life is good. And this is the point that I mentioned that we had taken up with some of it earlier. But it's very important to repeat this one. And you'll see that he says in the... I'll read you Sforno over here. If a person would live 2,000 years and he did not involve himself in anything which gives himself any good, what's the good he's talking about? He says in his commentary, he says, and he says to my point, and also he did not live a painful life in his long days. So you see, he does remove the pain from the equation. So he says, let's say we take a person who has no pain and he lives a long life. Will this person be better than the stillborn? You might think so. That's why he's bringing it up, right? So, and this person doesn't live a painful life. And even if he lives many double times, meaning 2,000 years, but in these lives he doesn't have any type of, he doesn't reach any hope for an eternal existence. Is it not to one place that everybody goes? Meaning to say that his soul and his body expire as soon as he reaches physical death. Meaning his soul with his physical body, he says here, and all the powers of his body. And therefore he doesn't reach the objective that was prepared for him in his life. That a person should attain an eternal existence. So what Sforno is saying is that if the person, even if he does not have pain, but if he's not involved in anything which gives himself eternal life, so who cares even if he lives 2,000 years? This person also is going to have the same end as the stillborn. In a few thousand years, it's going to equal out. He's trying to tell you that if a person does not attain an eternal existence for himself, so that he is no better off, even having lived, even without pain, even the good life, family, friends, food, travel, all these things. But if that life did not include anything which gave eternity to a soul, so then it was a waste, he's saying. And the reason why it's a waste, you tell me. And why is this person equivalent to the stillborn?
Rabbi?
Yes.
May I say? The stillborn didn't have a chance to do any mitzvot, and so he hasn't earned anything to carry into the next life. The person who doesn't do mitzvot in this life, even if it's 5,000 years, he hasn't accomplished anything. The whole purpose of life, the way I understand it, is that we are here to earn our mitzvot so that we go to the next life carrying the package, so to speak, of what we've done, all the good, because then that we don't have really a good next life. The whole purpose of the next life is to enjoy the rewards of what we accomplished here and benefit from the rewards and live in eternity, have Olam Haba.
So why, though, can't we say...
Is that true?
Yes, it's true. The whole purpose of this existence is that we attach ourselves to wisdom and we actually enjoy life here to a higher level than anybody who's a hedonist. But what we're also doing is we're attaching ourselves to that which can give our soul an eternity. And it's, of course, of immeasurably greater value that a person exists eternally than just even for a few thousand years. That's, of course, true. But I'd like to focus on the thing I want to focus on is that why can't we still say that, well, the person was here, he still had 2,000 years of family and friends and travel. Why can't we say that after the person's dead? Why is it that he's equal to... Why is he equal...
That's not earning mitzvot. It's not earning what...
I know that. I know.
I
know that.
I believe to make the best of what we can of this life, to earn... learn all the...
You're not answering the question.
...so to speak.
You're not answering the question.
And bring them with us. Okay, so this is... So that's why a child who dies and, you know, who's a stillborn, who hasn't had that opportunity, in a way, he has no other earth either. He has no sins.
Let's take the mitzvos. Excuse me.
What?
Let's take the question here is we're taking the mitzvos out of the equation. We already understand what he says, that the mitzvos were not done by the person who lived 2,000 years. Why isn't it still that this person who at least had 2,000 years of existence on earth, why isn't that better than a person who had no existence at all? That's the question.
What benefit does he have for afterwards? The whole purpose is the afterlife. I mean, if this life is meant to be fun and games,
why?
That's not what we're learning. We didn't learn that. Hashem has put us here specifically.
But didn't the person have 2,000 years?
Earn all the right. We're supposed to live the right way so we can earn the mitzvot and have the best afterlife. We'll be the afterlife much longer than the life we spend here on earth. And that's the whole purpose.
Why can't I say that the person at least had 2,000 years? He is better off than the person who was a stillborn. What is wrong with that statement? At least the person had 2,000 years.
A stillborn didn't make any sins.
Doug Ed.
Sorry.
Rivka, I hear you.
When you say, at least the person had 2,000 years, it's assuming that there is a person. This guy, if after 2,000 years he does not exist anymore, a person that doesn't exist anymore can't benefit from anything.
That's the answer.
You can't say that he, at least he had, because there's no he.
Right, exactly. That's the answer. The answer is that if we take the mitzvah side of the equation, fine. That we're assuming that, because he says that in verse 6, that let's say a person lived 2,000 years, but he saw no good, and according to the Targum, according to the commentators, that means that he was not involved in Torah. So fine. Now we're asking a question. You have two people. One person was a stillborn, one person lived 2,000 years and was not involved in Torah. But still, he had family and friends. Why can't I say, after he's dead, at least he had those 2,000 years? And the stillborn didn't have anything. Why can't I make that statement? So Josh is answering properly. Because once he's gone, if he's not involved himself in anything which gives eternity to a soul, so there is no he anymore. The soul is gone. It's as if he never existed. And that's what we said a couple months ago, that when a person goes to the funeral, so they recite one verse, which is similar to this. It says a person is a day old or even 1,000 years old. So, like, he is like one who never existed. If, of course, he has no soul. Meaning to say, if a person lives 2,000 years and is not involved in doing anything to give him an eternity, so then there is not the he anymore. He's completely gone. So you can't talk about, well, at least he had a good life. There is no he anymore. It's an abstract idea, but I think we can appreciate this. Rivka, do you see it?
Oh, that's excellent. That clarifies the whole thing. Josh, thank you.
Okay.
I see it very clearly.
That's why they're
equal. I didn't know how to explain it. But that's perfect. I couldn't bring it out.
Right.
But there is no benefit. But I didn't say it the way Josh did. That Josh hit it right on the head. Thank you.
Right. Does everybody else see it? Is that clear to everybody?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, we actually grappled this, Doug, months ago, remember?
I'd love to say yes, but my memory seems to have a leak in it.
Don't feel bad, I don't remember it, Rabbi, I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem.
I really am sorry.
No problem.
But it's so important that we understand that, because that's the whole idea of being following the mitzvahs and the life that you're trying to teach us in so many ways. Thank you.
All right, so let's move on. If it's clear to everybody, let's go on to the next verse. All right, because I want to do two more verses now. Anybody have any questions up to this point? Okay.
I had one question in reference to the baby not living. He has become and he's lost all at the same time. In other words, the baby has no eternity, has no olam haba.
It had no existence, right? So there's no nothing at all. Like it never existed. Okay. All right. Now, he says, verse 7. How does 7 read? He says, for all the labors of man are to his mouth, and also his soul is not full. Why is this? What is he saying, and why is this come here now? Even saying that during life itself, he already told you that the person's not going to have an eternity, but even during this life itself, he's not going to have satisfaction.
Right.
Okay. All right. Let me read you the Sforno on this. So it seems to be still talking about the stillborn, because it says that it will occur to this one just like what occurred to the other person who toiled all his days just for his mouth. Meaning he only concerned himself with his physical existence. And he says, "The Masha in the Mechaver the Hate of Vilas Vasagam Nasha was Avilov." Right. So he says what you just said, Doug. That's what Sforno says. Okay. The way I viewed this is that what he was now saying was an explanation as to why people live this way. Because why is a person going this way? He's lived these thousands of years, and he's not involved in the Torah. He's not involved in ideas because of 7. Because the motivation of such people is that they only live for their mouth. Meaning they're living based on a physical existence. And if this is so, it flows on to verse 8, where he says, therefore, I'm throwing in the word therefore, but I think it belongs there. Because he starts off 8 with the word because. Meaning, because of this in 7, that the person lives this way. Right? And this is what Rashi says as well. He says, all the labor of a man is just for his mouth. They should benefit in this world. Right? Okay, I'm not sure if that is what we're actually saying. Let's just go with Sforno. But if we say that that's so, that he's now explaining why a person will have a wasted existence if he even lives 2,000 years, is because he's only going after the physical existence. And then he said that this is so. So verse 8 says, so what benefit would there be to even a wise person who followed this path over a fool? I mean, even if a wise person goes this way, so then he loses his whole merit. He's really not wise to begin with. And in 9, he says, I believe, what the underlying... let's hold on for now. I'd like you to tell me what it says. But I just want to see the flow. the flow is that once you see that the person even lives 2,000 years, it's worthless. Then he explains why, because the person's rooted in just the physical. Okay, let me see if there's anybody else who comments on that.
Rabbi?
Yeah, 1 second. So 1 second. Ko'amo. He says 2 points in Ibn Ezra that he doesn't, the man just lives for this life. And even so, like you said, Doug, again, it looks like Ibn Ezra also agrees with you, where he says that a person won't be satisfied even if he has all the wealth in the world. Because that's where he's looking for his satisfaction. Go ahead, Doug, you had a question.
Yeah, I'm bothered by the introduction in the first half of 8 about wisdom. Because we've been talking up till now about somebody who's just looking at the physical, we're not talking about mitzvahs. And then he says, for what is the advantage of the wise over the fool? But as soon as you introduce the concept of being wise, it would seem like you're introducing the concept of the development of the soul.
Right. But it seems to be that the wise person can also make a mistake. Because he says in Ibn Ezra that if the wise person will seek out money, so there'll be no end. And then he says his soul will not be full, just like the soul of the fool.
Okay, so he's taking the wisdom and applying it to trying to obtain the physical.
Right. I mean, if he uses wisdom and then he goes after the physical, then his wisdom is not helping him out.
Gotcha.
Then he's really not living wisely, because if he's seeking out, if that's what he's searching for in life, if the wise man will seek after money, then there won't be an end to it. Right? And his soul, because he says he's susceptible to the same flaws as anybody else. There's no guarantee till the day you die that you're not going to switch your path. So if a person even is on the right path, but then he switches gears, so then he could lose it also. Let's see. Right. So if a person is not looking for this is the Sforna now. He says, even if he has a long life, and it doesn't, it does not awaken in him to strive after any eternal type of acquisition, any eternal type of wealth, meaning this the wealth of the soul, then he's not going to be any, the wise man will be no better than the fool. I mean, if that's where the person is then applying his wisdom to try to acquire this world, so then he's not going to be any better than the fool. He'll end up going to the same place, and that will be the end of both. Why is he bringing him here is a good question, though.
Rabbi, would you say it fits in because we're talking about what's left for us after we do die? And if we're just living this world, then maybe he's trying to give us an explanation that this world isn't it. And I'm just thinking out loud.
Yeah. What's bothersome is that, like Doug said, why is he bringing in the wise man over here? What is the...
Wise man should know.
Yeah, that's obvious. Idea. That's obvious, though.
Yeah, it requires repetition. A lot of things are obvious, but maybe I'm not. We have to go by what's written.
Yeah.
And what I'm just saying is, repetition usually helps us learn. Maybe it's the repetition part that we need to hear. It's very hard to grasp. People don't grasp it. That this world isn't it.
Well, let's look at the verse. Maybe the verse has the answer.
Yeah.
Maybe the verse has the answer. Let's take a look at the verse again. What benefit is that to the wise man over the fool? And what is there to the poor person that he knows how to go? Let's see what translates that. I mean, the commentation. Let's see what they're saying.
There's a lot of interference. Hard to hear.
Yeah.
Rabbi, the wise man...
One second.
Wise.
Just give me 1 second.
Trying to teach the fool, isn't it?
1 second.
Okay.
I just want to look at it myself. 1 second. I mean, it could also be a rationalization that the person who wants to justify the path that he's on, so he may say the words, what benefit is there to the wise man over the fool then? I mean, it's in this, insofar as they're just traveling this life, as the end of the verse, in connection with this life.
Solomon speaking on behalf of those under the sun?
Right, the latter. There's two ways to understand it. Like we said earlier, that if a person, like Ibn Ezra and Sforno said, that if a person is wise but he tries to seek out wealth as an end in itself, so then he's going to be the same thing as a fool. But you could also read it as if it's the word, he's quoting the words of some people who want to justify. I mean, now that a person is just living a life for his mouth, as we said in verse 7, and his soul just doesn't get full. So if he's living that way, so then a person can justify. So why bother being wise?
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Rabbi, being wise means that you know what's important. Being a fool means you have no idea.
Well, no, a wise person could apply his wisdom for the wrong ends, for the wrong means.
Oh, but when we talk about the wise person, don't we mean wise in total knowledge?
Yeah, but a person who's wise in here evidently is doing something wrong. Seems to be saying that your wisdom doesn't save you if at a certain point you switch your path in life.
To me, wisdom means wisdom in Torah. So that's why I'm saying the correct thing.
But if he changes his path, then it seems to be it's useless. He lost his merit.
When you read it, Rabbi, and you see the wise man, what does it say to you? Does it say wise man in Torah knowledge or wise man in worldly knowledge?
Just a wise man. That's all it says.
Wise.
The person who has wisdom. The person who has wisdom, but then uses it for the wrong plan, so then it's worthless.
Then he's not wise anymore. He's lost his wisdom.
No, he's still wise, but his values, his virtues.
Yeah.
You can have wisdom, but not have virtue.
Virtue, that's right. Okay.
You have many wise people in business today that are not religious at all, so what does the wisdom do for the soul? Nothing. But they're wise, they're definitely wisdom.
Right.
Okay, let's just do the last verse, because we're coming to the end here. The last verse says, Better is what the eyes see than what the soul than how the soul travels. And this also is a futility and a vexation of spirit. What does he say in this last verse over here? Who's speaking here?
Solomon.
Right, Solomon's speaking, but certainly not on behalf of himself. So I think he's saying here is the cause now for why the person is going to live the physically rooted life. Because it's what the eyes see are very, very convincing. And a person has the opinion that better is what I see with my eyes. Let me gather that money. Let me keep that money. Let me go after this physical existence. Then I should do something that is intangible, meaning the goodness of my soul. And this is exactly what Sforno says. He says, better off, and this is the opinion of the fools, better off is the acquisition that I can reach in my senses, that means in my physical existence, right? Then I should go with my soul. And he says, more preferred is the physical than going with my soul, my intelligence, to acquire an eternal existence, which is something which I don't reach here. So a person is convinced by what he sees and feels and touches and smells and tastes. And because of this, because of the sensual nature of a human being, but primarily the eyes. And that's why the Shema says that you shouldn't go after your eyes and after your heart, because the initial compelling emotion is generated from visual, from what your eyes see. So that's why God writes in the Shema that you should not go chase after your eyes, right, and after your hearts, because the eyes see, the heart wants, and the body does, they say. So that's what it says over here, that the cause of this type of a lifestyle, where the person is just looking for what he can acquire physically. Let me get the biggest house, the biggest chance at fame, and the accolades of my peers. This is what the person is chasing after, because this is what he's convinced is real. This is what he sees. So he's allowing his senses to convince him of what reality is. That's where the original sin is in the person. That's where it all stems from. So you see that Solomon's tracing back the lifestyle, using examples, and why the stillborn is going to be equivalent to somebody who lives thousands of years and is not involved in anything eternal, so he hasn't anything left afterwards because he's gone at that point. And he says, but where does that come from? Why does a person travel that path? Because he's living for the sensations. But then he says one more step, the sensations, living for the here and now and the physical, and just trying to acquire. Like he says in 7, a person toils for his mouth. He wants something which is tangible, because the original sensation that really gets a person motivated to go after the physical is what the eyes see. So that's, I believe, what he's doing in this series of verses, is showing you in action what the flaw is, and really the evaluation of the type of person like this is just like a stillborn. But why does he live in that path? Well, he's living that path because he is rooted in the physical. But why is he rooted in the physical? That's because it's what the eyes see. And this is a futility, because now the person is just reacting without thinking. If he would think and he'd analyze and he'd see that the existence he can have could be eternal, then he would have the incentive to control his lusts and his urges and try to apply his intelligence to arrive at what's real to his mind. And eventually, his mind can overpower his emotions if he invests the time that's necessary. Okay? All right, let's see if there's any questions or comments.
That says it all.
I just want to go back and reconfirm one issue. You indicated that a child, a baby, let's say, is born and dies 5 days later. Then the soul has no development, and so it's as if they never existed. Did I understand that correctly?
That's right.
Okay.
how God deals with that soul is his decision. It's not for us to, we don't know.
Yeah.
But we know that God's just. We see from creation how he created every single species that knows exactly where to get its food, how to get shelter. The design of one fish's mouth is for swallowing other fish. The design of another fish's mouth can barely open because it's only eating lichen. And it's interesting that both fish know how to go after their prey. They have the ability to swim. They have the right fins. They have the right body composition. Everywhere in the universe, all and the fruits, they taste so good. And everything that man needs, the opposing thumb, no matter what it is, you see that it's revealing that there is a just system. God did not create something without its ability to attain its needs. So we are convinced from all of this, and we see nothing lacking in the universe. The only thing lacking is man's poor decisions. So when we see questions like this, so we have to agree that, you know, God's the one that created the universe. He's got all the answers. So if we don't have an answer, we don't know the reason of the Holocaust, or we don't know why this baby had to die in 5 days. That's God's area, but we shouldn't have any question on that. Certainly, that should not remove our appreciation and our conviction of his justice in every other area that we saw. There's going to be many areas in life that we don't know. That has to be, because we're not God. So we shouldn't come away with something which leaves a question. We should come away with a conviction that that's got to be just too, and we just don't know. We can only explore as far as humanly possible. And actually, there's a statement for the there's a Mishnah, meaning the oral law is broken up into different chapters, and the chapters are broken up into what we call a Mishnah. Each Mishnah, so a Mishnah is like a section of a few sentences. So in the Talmud Chagiga, you take a look. I think it's 11b. It says over there that there's only four things that are off limits to man that he's not allowed to ponder, and if he does, it's better off that he wasn't born. And those four things are based on a verse. And the four things are that a man is not allowed to ask what came before the earth and what comes after the earth, what's above and what's below. Because in those four areas, what came before the earth and what's coming after, there's no way to penetrate it. So it's useless to delve into that. And it's equally useless to try to think about, well, what's outside the reaches of what our eyes can examine in the universe and what's below the earth, meaning inside the earth. Nobody's going to get to the center of the earth and tell us what's there. So, but aside from that, we're allowed to investigate. But I would say that this thing about, you know, the child and what happens, that means, like, you know, before the earth and after the earth, meaning after our relationship to the earth, our existence. So what happens after a person leaves here, we have transmission of the rabbis, and even the non-Jewish philosophers convinced of the existence, the eternity of the soul, if a person lives properly. But how do certain cases work? If a child is stillborn or 5 days old and then dies, that's going to be meted out with justice and God's mercy, just like anything else. So we should have complete trust and conviction that it's going to be good.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, excuse me. Is it written anywhere in the scriptures that when we do go to Olam Haba at the afterlife, we will know why? We can't ask why here, but we will know why afterwards. Is it written anywhere like that?
Know why what?
Why, if any of the questions that we have questions about the Holocaust, about why a baby died, why this, why that, anything. Will we know the answers then? Will we have the opportunity to acquire the answers at that time?
I don't know.
Afterlife.
I don't know. Like the rabbis say, no eye has ever seen the next world.
Right.
However, God did tell Moses, when Moses asked God to understand his true nature, so God says that man can't know me while he's alive. So if you want to look up what the commentators say on that, perhaps there's something there. But you might want to say that God's just saying, yeah, while you're alive, you can't know me, Moses. And maybe that's only for Moses, too, so we don't know. But our objective is to engage, you know, as much time as we can in the greatest mitzvah, which is Torah study. And with the increase of knowledge, like Maimonides says, will come the increase of attachment of love to God, which means we'll come to enjoy this reality that God created even more, and we'll come more enthralled and intrigued and motivated to study even more, and that's really what the greatest enjoyment will be in our life here in the next world.
It makes sense. It makes sense.
Right. Okay, so was there any other questions or comments? You have about to say something further, Rivka?
No, it's just that we have this to look forward to in the afterlife if we live our lives properly.
Right, to a greater level.
And have faith. Pardon me?
To a much higher degree, too.
Yeah, well, I'm saying if we live our lives properly and continue to learn and continue to absorb all the important things all the learnings, all the svarim, everything we have the opportunity to learn from the svarim that are written now in English, and if we continue to learn that we should have faith that we will benefit because we can, it seems that if you're living the good life, you can feel it even when you're here, that there's something that makes you feel that it's right, that it's good, and that you want to continue.
Okay. All right, and anybody else? Any other questions or comments before we wrap it up for today?
No, thank you, Rabbi.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Rabbi.
All right, very good. Also, I suggest we did an article this week on in the Jewish Times. So take a look on Tehillim. It goes back to an idolatrous issue. So if you have the opportunity, I think the source is there. I got to thank my friend who actually brought them up over Passover. So he had them all consolidated. So it was easy for me to go through the sources. So take a look, and we'll meet back here at 11:15 next week. All right?
That was a good article on the Tehillim. Also, there's a good one on there, the one with Divine Providence.
Yeah, that was very well done.
That was a good explanation.
Yeah, it was very good.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, good week to everybody. My pleasure.
Good week, Rabbi. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Be well, everyone.